Following Nick Redfern was Linda Moulton Howe, who was talking about military whistleblowers. This was a really powerful presentation featuring some audio from an interview Linda did with some whistleblowers who were stationed in Florida tracking a UFO on radar. They tried to lock onto it, and the UFO would, like, shot back some kind of pulse and reversed the polarization on all the equipment and, like, ruined a bunch of radar equipment. It was fascinating stuff. She also had a video that she showed of an interview she had with a former military guy who, while he was working on a base somewhere, got into the files and saw some pictures of dead aliens. And Linda was also talking about harassment that goes on for some of the witnesses who try to contact her, and that was really frightening stuff. And from there, we moved on to Dr. Bruce McAfee, who was discussing a mysterious UFO incident from December 6, 1950. What was really interesting about Bruce's presentation was that he weaved in some autobiographical accounts from various folks who were in the government at the time, well-known people. I can't remember them off the top of my head. I apologize for that. But they wrote about this incident in their autobiographies, and he took a look at those and showed how the stories had changed over time, and also weaved in witness testimonies from a UFO incident from around that time, and really tried to tie all these together to get a look at really what was going on that night in December of 1950. Sunday evening and the conference as a whole wrapped up with Matthew Tooney as the final presentation. Matthew was talking about the Lummi Island incident, which is a purported crash of some object off the state of Washington in 1984. Matthew's done a great job looking into this story and really covered it with a lot of detail in his presentation. And as luck would have it, I ran into him at the end of the conference and we managed to talk a little bit about his presentation, the Lummi Island incident, and his overall view of the esoteric world and where he thinks it needs to be going, which was really fascinating stuff. So let's hear now from Matthew Tooney, the final presenter at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, and ironically enough, the final on-site interview from the big event. We are here in Las Vegas at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4, and I am here with Matthew Tooney, who was talking about a very interesting potential UFO crash in the Washington area. Matthew, why don't you let everybody who couldn't make it here to Vegas bring them up to speed on what you were talking about?
Okay, short synopsis. In July of 1984, a mysterious object, described as a fireball trailing sparks, crashed into the northern Puget Sound between Lummi and Eliza Islands in the northern Sound, just off of the town of Bellingham in Bellingham Bay. There were witnesses aboard two different vessels. One vessel was only about 1,000 to 1,500 yards away from where the splashdown occurred. And saw the object do a strange maneuver, kind of a U-turn before heading into the water, whereupon it threw up a wall of water about 70 to 100 feet high. And after it went under, the water sort of boiled and roiled and bubbled for about 10 minutes thereafter. And the ship, the small fishing vessel, went over to check it out and called the Coast Guard and tell them. So, we have the Coast Guard records. The Coast Guard responded immediately and went to see what was going on. While they were en route, they radioed Whidbey Island Naval Air Station, which is a major military installation in the Puget Sound region between Seattle and the Canadian border. Whidbey said, "No, we didn't have anything on our radar. We don't know of anything going down at that point." They also contacted either, I'm not sure which agency it was, either Air Force Space Command or NORAD, either of which would have been tracking any kind of satellite that would have come down at that time. So there was no record of anything that would have been coming out of orbit at that time, and there was apparently was nothing on radar. So we know that much. The Coast Guard searched the area at that point, since they figured it's not space junk. It might have been a plane, so they were looking for debris on the surface of the bay and found nothing. And that was pretty much the end of it until about 5 months later, when a private recovery mission was put together, sort of on a shoestring. These were folks out of Seattle to the south of Bellingham. And they brought a team north, two seasoned divers, and a guy who was basically the financial muscle, I think. And he didn't commandeer, he rented a boat, although he didn't pay for the gas, it was a shoestring. He rented a boat, a fishing vessel out of Bellingham, and I have interviewed the captain of that vessel, Dominic Papetti, and he tells about what happened was, and this was December 30th, 1984, cold, clear night, or actually this was a daytime, and they went out, parked over the object. Well, they didn't know that there was an object there yet, but they found it on the depth finder, located an object about 10 feet by 30 feet, and appeared to be wedged into the bay floor at about a 45-degree angle. So the divers proceeded to dive upon the object, about 120 feet of water. I forgot to mention that in the presentation. And one diver described a kind of goldish metallic object with a ring running around the edge of it and a kind of a porthole or a latch on one end. The other fellow actually stood on the object, and he described it as a satellite dish, which in those days, 1984, those were pretty humongous affairs. They were big ones. And as he stood on it, he reported hearing or feeling or sensing a kind of vibrating sound, motion, like it was alive or it was the switch was on. And that second diver was so excited that he ascended way too rapidly and got a pretty bad case of the bends, and because he wanted to tell what he had seen. So they came back to the Bellingham Harbor, saw to his welfare. The diver was okay, it turned out. They decided to go back the very next day and try and figure out a way to maybe dislodge the object and bring it, float it up somehow. Which they did. They went back the next day and found nothing. The divers dove around the area again, couldn't find anything, nothing on the depth finder. And as it turns out, between those two daylight dives in the middle of the night on December 30th, according to many witnesses in the Bellingham Harbor, the lights of a large vessel were seen steaming northward from the Seattle area. A lot of the witnesses claim it was a NOAA vessel. That's the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. I'm not sure why they say that, but apparently the configuration of the lights, what it looked like, yeah, that sort of thing. This vessel, in the middle of the night, parked right over where the object had been located the day before. Was there apparently for 3 or 4 hours, something like that, and then steamed back south towards Seattle. And as I mentioned, the next day, the private crew went up back out and there was nothing there. So, did that ship take the object? We don't know. Did the object leave of its own accord? Maybe. It's an ongoing mystery, and one I still have a lot of research to do into.
Awesome. And I wanted you to just kind of speak to what you were saying about real science. Is that what you was called?
True science.
Can you speak to that a little bit? Because I really found that to be very profound.
Well, good. I was afraid I was coming off a bit preachy, but it's a big concern to me. What we're up against, those of us who study the paranormal, I think it's quite normal. what we're up against is a mainstream scientific community that refuses to do science when it comes to these events, these energies, these experiences that many of us have had and seen and witnessed. And that really bothers me. And it's what bothers me even more is that our community, whether it's the UFO community, the Bigfoot research community, psychics, ghosts, whatever, tends to become divided into little, like, armed camps of with different agenda and egos, and little wars going on, and that tends to make us even less valid in the eyes of the mainstream defenders of the paradigm, you know. So that bugs me. I think we need to get together in a spirit of inclusion and compare research, compare data, and mainstream science is not going to tackle this thing. It's not what they want to hear. These things don't exist because they can't exist. Why can't they exist? Because they don't exist. You know, I mean, it becomes a circuitous thing. And so, I really have a lot of respect for folks who come to conferences like this, researchers and just the people who are attending who have an honest and valid interest in these things and are willing to do the work.
Where can people find more information about you and your research and stuff like that?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have a website up yet, so they can email me at mdtooney, that's like Matthew David Tooney, T-H-U-N-E-Y, at msn.com.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate it, and I enjoy your presentation a lot, and good luck with your future research.
Thank you, anytime.
There you go, folks. That was Matthew Tooney talking about his presentation on the Lummi Island incident and also some thoughts on esoterica in general. Big thanks to Matthew for taking some time to talk to us. From there, Ryan Wood thanked everybody for attending and wrapped up the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4. And as such, we'll wrap up my on-site style coverage here for you. Hopefully, I gave you a pretty good idea of what went down at the UFO CRC. This may be the longest I've ever talked on an All of America audio episode, but, you know, that's what makes it a special. And now, we're going to go beyond the on-site coverage of the UFO CRC. We're going to go behind the curtain and find out a little bit more about how it's all put together from the director and creator of the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, Ryan Wood. Here now is Ryan Wood from November 30th, 2006, a scant 3 weeks removed from the big weekend in Vegas, talking about the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4. Ladies and gentlemen, we're here with the man behind the scenes, the guy that put it all together, Ryan Wood, and we talked to you in May, we had you on the show, and we talked about the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference and included that portion of our interview in a recent episode right before I went out to Vegas. So a lot of people here are really familiar with the UFO conference, and they've heard by now through this episode a lot about it from all the on-site interviews and my recap and stuff. So I figured once things settled down a little bit, we'd bring you on here and sort of do like a little look back and post-look at the conference, because you hear a lot of hype about conferences, and then sort of you never hear anything about them afterwards. So Ryan, you know, welcome to the show here. Thanks for taking some time to talk to me.
Yeah, well, thanks, Tim. I look forward to sharing with your audience what I've learned from the fourth annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference.
Awesome, awesome. Well, for starters, just why don't you give me like just your post thoughts here on the conference? Like I said, we're 2 weeks removed from it, so I'm sure you've had some time for the dust to settle a little bit. Just give some reflections on it.
Well, I'm real happy with the way it turned out. I think it's the best conference that I've put on, not only from point of view of logistics and execution, but also from speaker quality and audience joy and getting what they want. So we had 340-some-odd people attend, which was up about 120 from last year.
Oh, awesome.
And so I was real happy with that participation. We had a good hotel. Everybody liked the hotel rooms and the environment. So I think the logistics were good. The speakers enjoyed themselves. There was a couple of really stunning surprises in my mind. I mean, you know, as the conference organizer, you pick certain speakers that you've heard before, and then at the other times you take risks and give people a forum to do something you think is appropriate. And sometimes they underwhelm you, and sometimes they blow you away.
Yeah.
And I was pleasantly surprised with a couple of the talks that were in my sort of unknown category that turned out really good.
Yeah.
One of them was Paul Shatskin,
yeah.
Who did the biography of T. Townsend Brown and his linkages into, espionage and anti-gravity and ultimately a time machine, which is, you know, highly speculative, but, you know, we've heard inklings in the Philadelphia experiment and other books and documents and tantalizing evidence that maybe there really is a time machine. And this just added to that, although that wasn't the major thrust of his talk. But that was a real positive surprise in my mind.
Yeah. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you to kind of break the fourth wall here, you sort of touched on a little bit, is how do you choose the speakers when you're putting together the conferences now? Obviously, this is the fourth year, so you've had a lot of experience with arranging for speakers and stuff. How do you decide who to bring in and that kind of thing?
Well, it's... there's three things I think about One is, what's the reputation of the person that may come? How big an audience draw do they have? What's their sort of fame quotient?
Yeah.
That's one thought. The second thought is, how good a public speaker are they? I mean, how well can they deliver an engaging speech? And do they read their speeches or not? And can they ad-lib well? Can it be humorous? Can it be an enjoyable experience for somebody sitting in the audience? And so that's another key factor that I look at. And then the last element is the content, the unusual nature of the content. Is it on point? Is it about a crash retrieval? Do they have something interesting, provocative, new, fresh to say and deliver to the audience? And so some people, you know, have low fame quotient and, you know, good public speaking skills and interesting stuff. And so you end up getting a score based on those three parameters.
Kind of like the UFO crash book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and I'm not as rigorous with the speakers as I am with the crash book, but that's the basic idea of what I target from a speaker point of view and how you choose them. But ultimately, I start with content, and I want to have, you know, 4, 5, 6 specific one-hour talks about crash retrievals, and there's generally 14 speakers in a 2.5 day, a 2.25 day weekend. So it's a lot of content, a lot of depth. Most of the talks are 50 minutes, 55 minutes, and that's different than other conferences where people are given an hour and a half or 2 hours to talk about something, and it gets dry, long, and boring.
Mm-hmm. Like, I'd always heard musical artists and how important it is, the order of the songs on their albums, and a lot of things sort of like to build sort of an order. How much thought do you put into when you're putting together the order of the presentations, or is it more of like dictated by circumstance, like, you know, this guy has to get in at this time or something like that?
Generally, all the speakers are there in time, so it's not driven by speaker logistics. I guess what I like to have is somebody to get your attention first thing, first time, be, you know, festive and engaging for the first couple of talks, and then generally before lunch on each of the days, you want to make sure to have a very strong speaker so that the buzz at lunch is, wow, wasn't that great?
Yeah.
And so there's some of that, and then and ideally you want to have a strong closing speech. And not that I adhered to this policy in the last crash conference perfectly, but that's what I like to do, and I think that next year I'm going to give even more attention to the order of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sure there's a lot that goes into sort of trying to fight the fatigue factor, too, at one of these conferences, because just from the three that I've been to total, that's just a grind of a weekend. So I'm sure you sort of have to look to that, too, as a barometer of how to plan things out.
Yeah, I mean, it's intense. I mean, you can give people longer breaks and give them less content, but then they feel a little more frustrated. Or not everybody is focused and wants to hear every talk. So I figure some people will, you know, of the 14 talks, they're going to say, well, I'm really excited about 10, and I'm going to, you know, sleep in or talk to my buddies or network on a couple of other ones.
Now, how far in advance do you plan the event? Like, now you're like I said, we're 2 weeks out of the last one. You're already sort of like setting the groundwork here for number 5?
I am setting the groundwork. Every year I've been doing it earlier and earlier, and just today I called the Tuscany Suites again and had them work up a quote for next year. So November 9, 10, 11 of next year is when I plan to have the next one.
Awesome. Awesome. And now one question that people seem to be asking me a lot for some reason at the conference was, why Vegas? You're from Colorado. We kind of touched on this yesterday, but let's dish it out here for the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, Vegas is an easy – they have good conference facilities, a lot of competition in managing that. They have easy, cheap flights from almost every major city in the U.S. and in many cases, international cities. Next year, we're probably going to have a couple of talks from the U.K. And, you know, there's a nonstop from London Heathrow to Las Vegas. There's a nonstop from, virtually every big city in the world to Vegas. And that's useful and it's competitive rates. So you can get back and forth from anywhere in, you know, a bordering state to Las Vegas for under $200. And that's nice.
Yeah. And now, why do you think the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference has been so successful? Like you said, the attendance actually grew from last year. In what would be an otherwise dreary conference market. We've seen some conferences start up and then peter out, and we know about the problems with New Fork, and everyone's kind of hoping there'll be another X conference, but that we don't know if that's ever going to happen. You know what I mean? The conference market seems to be kind of hurting, but the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference is doing really well. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's two elements to make a great conference. One is the execution of a lot of logistics and details of picking a good venue and picking good speakers, and then marketing it and promoting it well and getting the word out. So those are the things that are important. If you make it relevant, engaging, and interesting, the topics are fresh and new and not rehashed and regurgitated, and I've seen that all before, people will come.
Yeah.
And that's really my focus, and one of the reasons why I decided to do it was I was frustrated with going to other conferences and hearing about stuff that I thought shouldn't be on the podium. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think like a lot has to do with like the location too? Some places they sort of are off the beaten path locations, and also maybe they overshoot their load by bringing in too many stars, if you will, who are well known draws. But if you bring in like five or six of these well known draws, when one would suffice, next thing you know they've overblown their budget.
Well, there's always those challenges. I mean. You have to have a good sense of business management to run a conference. You know, I lost money on the first couple of conferences and am making back my money, and my wife is finally, okay, Ryan, you can do the fifth one. So you learn every time how to be more effective at this, and the broad brush organization of picking speakers and pulling it together is some of the most glamorous and easiest work. The hardest work is keeping the emails up, calling people. I mean, literally, I talked to every single person that came to the conference on the phone at least once.
Wow.
And that's the sort of dedication that it takes to pull it off and have people be happy.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like the UFO Crash Trail Conference definitely has strong word of mouth, too, which has got to help. It's got a great reputation as far as conferences go. Not only were you running the whole conference, but also you had a presentation. Can you just give a little thumbnail sketch for the people who missed the conference on what you were talking about? It was sort of a half-and-half Devil's Hole UFO crash case and also this exciting new project, the UFO Dex.
Yeah. Since I'm the organizer of the Crash Retrieval Conference, I feel compelled to get a good, fresh crash retrieval with hopefully hardware out of the ground. And I worked on this one in August of 1949 out in Devil's Hole, Nevada. And you know, I've got some newspaper articles that are suggestive. I've been to the site, got some intuitives involved, pretty confident that I've got the right site. There's some physical damage there. And hopefully there's evidence of parts that can be recovered out of the ground. So there's some low-level witnesses also suggestive of something unusual happening in that area, but not specifically in that site yet. So that's really the Devil's Hole crash in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. It's a good story. Minor prospecting, disc whizzes overhead, crashes in front of him. Two little ETs pop out, run around. He chases them a little bit through the desert, grabs a piece of wreckage, goes to the newspaper. They write a story about it, and then the disinformation and cover-up begins, and the stories are changed, and the people's names and the miners are changed, and the Air Force makes statements, and so it sort of gets buried and manipulated.
Yeah.
And so that was a fun one, and there's still more work to be done mm-hmm. on that one. The other part of my talk was what I think a really strategic and important aspect for the field, and that is the integration into a single intelligence portal of all the knowledge about UFOs. And when I say all the knowledge, I literally mean all the knowledge. So I've scanned, and just for a pilot program, I've scanned and OCR'd, optical character recognized, 150 different books in the UFO field. There's only about 4,000 total. And journals and periodicals and videotapes have been transcribed and sliced up into 2-minute segments that'll be served up, images, and the web can be scoured and mined for relevant information about particular topics in the UFO field. And once you get this silo of knowledge together in a web portal, mm-hmm. That's very strong and rich and deep, you can begin to do fun things quickly.
Yeah.
Like, you know, give me all the cases where there are motherships, and all of a sudden somebody with a little bit of research and motivation can publish a book about motherships.
Mm-hmm.
Or give me all the incidents in Wyoming.
Yeah.
Or New Mexico, and or all the crossover between the RAND Corporation and UFOs. So you can begin to really mine and explore the true nature of the phenomenon and our cover-up, because there's two problems here. There's really the phenomenon. Do we understand it? What is it? How does it work? Et cetera, et cetera. And then, why is it here? And then the cover-up.
Yeah.
Who specifically is involved? What are they trying to do? Et cetera. Who knows the truth? And why are they being so stupid? So both those things can be accomplished with UFODEX, and UFODEX.net is the URL. It's not up yet, but it will be available sometime in January for beta testing and sort of pilot surfing.
Nice. So UFODEX.net is the URL, and people can check it out sometime at the beginning of 07 or so?
Yeah, beginning of 07.
Awesome. This sounds really exciting. I'm looking forward to checking this out when it gets up and running, and I think it's going to be just a boon for a lot of people.
Right.
And now, just to sort of wrap it up here, I saw a lot of people doing filming there. Are there going to be DVDs available of the presentations? And if so, where can people get those DVDs?
Oh, yeah. The DVDs are available on my website, ufoconference.com. And you can click on the products button and order the DVD conference set, as well as individual DVDs. So, and the conference proceedings, which is a wonderful...
Oh, that was awesome. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no other conference in UFOs that I'm aware of that publishes a conference proceedings except for the Mutual UFO Network.
Yeah.
And so that's new and different, and and I want to keep that going.
Yeah, that was one of the coolest aspects of it when I checked in. I got this fat book, too, and I was like, what is this? This is awesome. All right, so you can grab the DVDs and the conference proceedings at the URL again for that?
UFOconference.com.
Awesome. And next year's conference is the 9th, 10th, and 11th in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Tuscany Resorts and Casino, right?
That's right.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. I had a great time out there in Vegas. Hopefully I'll see you there next year as well. And good luck with edition number 5 of the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference.
All right. Well, thanks, Tim. Great to be on your program.
There you go, folks. That was Ryan Wood. Big thanks to Ryan Wood for taking some time and giving us a look behind the scenes of the UFO CRC. As Ryan said, you can pick up DVDs of the various presentations from the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference at www.ufoconference.com. Also, next year's UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, the 5th edition, will be held November 9th, 10th, and 11th at the Tuscany Hotel and Casino. If you've never been to a UFO conference, this is definitely one of them to check out. And with that, we pretty much wrap up the Been All of America Audio UFO Crash Retrieval Conference special. Thanks to Richard Dolan, Nick Redfern, Michael Sala, Paul Shatskin, and Matthew Tooney for taking some time out of the busy weekend to be a part of this special episode. And, of course, as I said, big thanks to Ryan Wood for the post-conference thoughts. If you want to hear more from Richard Dolan, Nick Redfern, Ryan Wood, or Dr. Michael Sala, definitely check out the Been All of America audio archives. Each of those four folks have been guests on the show previously for some lengthy interviews. So if you want to hear more from them, definitely check out our archives. Moving right along, normally we would be doing the Been All of America audio listener feedback segment here. But in light of all the talking I've done this week and some technical difficulties we've had at BeenAllOfAmerica.com over the weekend that have delayed the arrival of this week's episode, we're going to skip over this and resume Been All of America audio listener feedback next week with perhaps one of the most hilarious letters I've ever received. It is my very first hate mail, and trust me, it has to be heard to be believed, but it is a wild one, and I'll be reading that hate mail next week in the Been All of America audio listener feedback segment of the show and responding to it, of course. Wrapping up this week's show now, I want to thank Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, Joe V., and Ralph Molesworth of BeenAllOfAmerica.com for your help and support with the audio series and the website. I would not be able to do what I do without their help and support, so hats off to the gang and staff at BOA. BeenAllOfAmerica.com, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. If you're a longtime Been All of America audio listener or an appreciative newcomer, or you just want to share in the holiday spirit, and you want to help support the audio series and the website, click the PayPal button at BeenAllOfAmerica.com, make a donation, every little bit helps, and would be immensely appreciated. Next week on Been All of America Audio, it is the first half of a marathon conversation with Bill Ryan of Project Serpo fame. Bill Ryan burst on the scene as the webmaster for Serpo.org. He was on the front lines of the Serpo story that exploded over the course of 2006. For a long time, I sort of poo-pooed the Serpo story. My textbook response was, give it a year and then we'll take a look at it. So it's been a year and now it's time to take a look at the Serpo story. But unlike some of the other interviews you've heard and coverage of the Serpo story, we're not going to waste your time talking about the Ebens and what kind of games they played on Serpo. We're going to look at the story behind the Serpo story. How did it start? What was its evolution like? Why is it seemingly fizzled out now? And what can we learn about the Serpo story with regards to how major UFO stories break in the field of ufology? It's Bill Ryan talking about the Serpo story. Next week, December 9th, 2006, on Been All of America Audio. On that note, I bid you farewell for another week, my friends. You'll be hearing from me next week with more Been All of America Audio. Until then, this is Tim Been All, signing off.